So thank you all for coming out tonight. Just a few words, and I'll introduce Marcus Wicker here. Required thank yous, of course. So this event is co-sponsored by the Michigan Writers Series here in the library. Michael Rodriguez has been instrumental in getting this event up and running. Thank you. Thank you also to Glenn Chambers, the director of the AAAS program, for co-sponsorship, as well as Lori Hollinger and Anita Skeen from the Center for Poetry. And also to Diane from Everybody Reads, who's in the back there, and she will be selling books after this event. And I'm sure we can get Marcus to sign a few copies, too. This is part of the Michigan Writers Series. And I should say that all the events as part of this series are recorded and are eventually available for streaming through the library catalog. So that's a really cool thing. And you can get a sense of the range of writers who've come to campus here and done readings in various ways. It's gone on for how many years, Michael? Long time.
About 2000.
2000. Okay, so that's 16 plus years of history of American poetry. This is, in fact, the third year that we've co-sponsored a January reading and holding one this week between the Martin Luther King's legacy celebration on Monday and the inauguration on Friday. It feels particularly right to me. I've been feeling the urgency of poetry even more lately and the need for spaces like this with friends. And so I'm very grateful this week to be here with all of you and to feature the work of Marcus Wicker. A graduate of Indiana University's MFA program in creative writing, Marcus is currently teaching creative writing here in the Department of English. His first book of poems, Maybe the Saddest Thing, won the National Poetry Series and was a finalist for the NAACP Image Award. Marcus's work is steeped in the pleasures of contemporary pop culture, offering up love letters to pop icons like RuPaul, it's one of my personal favorites, Dave Chappelle, and Richard Pryor, even as it makes use of traditional forms and high lyric. Poetry, his work insists on every page, is relevant cultural critique. It's also beautiful, orally resonant, meant as much to be read aloud as on the page. His Ode to the World Wide Web provocatively ends, O World Wide Web, O viral video, O God of excrement, thought, befriend me, be fucking infectious, move my eyes from one sight to the next. It is through and alongside this exploration of pop culture that Marcus provides an extended riff on race and masculinity in America in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. This project takes on even more weight in his second book, Silencer, which is forthcoming from Houghton Mifflin in the fall. Sometimes, Marcus writes, in Silencer to the Heart while jogging through a park, sometimes I can barely walk out into daylight wearing a cotton sweatshirt without trembling. Marcus Wicker is the recipient of numerous accolades, including a Ruth Lilly Fellowship from the Poetry Foundation, a Pushcart Prize, the Missouri Review's Miller Audio Prize, as well as fellowships from Cave Canem and the Fine Arts Work Center. He's also a Michigan poet, having grown up in Ann Arbor and attended Western Michigan for his undergraduate degree, and we'll forgive him that. So it's a real pleasure and honor to welcome him here to Michigan Writers Series tonight. Thank you.
How's everybody doing? Good. Thank you for that, Robin. That was great. I'll try to live up to it. So I thought what I'd do for you is read just a few poems for Maybe the Saddest Thing, three or four, and then if it's okay with you, I'll read you some new stuff from Silencer. All right? Cool. Show of hands, how many people know who Flavor Flav is in here? Oh, good. That's not always the case. All right. This starts with an epigraph from Langston Hughes. We know we are beautiful and ugly, too. Love letter to Flavor Flav. I think I love you. How you suck fried chicken grease off chalkboard fingers in public, or walk the wrong way down an escalator with a clock around your neck. How you rapped about the poor with a gold tooth grin, how your gold teeth spell your name, how you love your name is beautiful. You shout your name 100 times each day. They say, if you repeat something enough, you can become it. I'd like to know, does Flavor Flav sound ugly to you? I think it's slightly beautiful. I bet you love mirrors. Tell the truth. When you find plastic Viking horns or clown shades staring back, is it beauty you see or vaudeville? To express myself honestly enough, that, my friends, is very hard to do. Those are Bruce Lee's words. I mention Bruce Lee here only because you remind me of him. That's a lie. But your shades do mirror a mask he wore, his Green Hornet's trusty sidekick. No, I'm not calling names. Chuck D would have set cities on fire had you let him. You were not Public Enemy's sidekick. You hosed down whole crowds and loudmouth flame retardant spit. You did this only by repeating your name. I think I love you. I think I really might mean it this time. William. Can I call you William? I should have asked 27 lines ago, what have you become? How you've lived, saying nothing save the same words each day, is a kind of freedom or beauty. Please, tell me I'm not lying to us. All right. I went to this private Catholic school in Ann Arbor, Michigan, from first through eighth grade. My father had sort of a different upbringing in Detroit. He was an amateur jazz musician, played the stand-up bass. But when I think about the music that I was into, you know, in middle school, it was like Jars of Clay, Green Day, Faith Hill. And so I wish that I could say this is a prose poem about my musical evolution, but really it's more like autobiography or memoir about just what happened to me and my father one day. If you're a jazz fan, you might get this. Everything I know about jazz, I learned from Kenny G. All right, so not really. But the morning my pops found Kenny G lying on my nightstand, I did learn a black father can and will enter a bedroom, only to find Kenny's CD, bad perm and all, cuddled too close to his eighth grader's head. He will tiptoe from the room, turn the knob, then kick the door down in slippers. He'll drag the boy out of bed, down two flights of stairs, and toss him in front of a turntable. Listen here, he says. When you finish a record, put it back in the sleeve, and you better not scratch my shit. I curl into a ball on our shag brown carpet and stare at his wall of LPs. Breakfast folds into lunch before I move an inch. When supper rolls around, I am shaking. This is how jazz begins, out of hunger. Getting to my feet, I pull a record from the shelf, read Black Talk, Charles Erland. A needle collides into an empty groove and outsweats a funky wash of organ. It feels like the Afro's voice grinning from the record sleeve has picked itself out in my gut. Eric Dolphy squeals, leaps, and dives inside my abdomen. Roy Ayers kneads and vibrates my chest. Freddie Hubbard's wail could crack glass, my ribs. Pharoah Sanders shivers all over my face. Every wax gash, nick, and hiss, every cut, every record pierces skin. I tap, I drone, I thrash, I scream. I listen to the Freedom Now suite. It sounds like a welted voice, wincing at the basement's night. A voice my father hears too. He does not cave the basement door. He walks a dirge down those steps. Gently strokes my neck, asks, "Why are you crying, son?" "Dad," I ache, "because I've been down here forever." If you want to clap for that one, you can. Why, thank you. Why, thank you. All right. So just one more from this book. So right now I work at Southern Indiana Review. At one point I worked at Indiana Review. I've judged lots of contests for magazines and book contests. One thing that I've learned is that poets are pretty good at keeping up with the Joneses, writing about the same thing, whether they know it or not, right? So, you know, sometimes I've worked at a magazine, there'd be a submission period of all pomegranate poems or all landscapes with no landscapes in them. And this is from the season of Abauds. Inexplicably, I was getting all these Abauds, right? Which is a mourning song that's written for lovers who are departing. And all the Abauds that I would get were very cheeky and playful. So I thought that I'd write a poem making fun of those poems. But as I started to do that, something happened, or something happened to me. Interrupting Abaud, ending an epiphany. Could I call this poem an Abaud if I wrapped it in fragrant tissue paper? If I locked this morning in the mine safe deposit box and polished it 66 times per day? Until a sky's description noted the number of feathers on a sparrow's left wing and the crabgrass jutting from his uppity beak. I once wrote a poem about a fruit fly orgy in a grape's belly. Its crescendoed combustion was supposed to represent the speaker's feelings for a wife named Joy. That poem never really worked out. This poem is aware of its mistakes and doesn't care. This poem wants to be a poem so bad it'll show you a young, smitten pair poised in an S on a downy bed. The man inhales the woman's sweet hair, and whole fields of honeysuckle and jasmine bloom inside him. He inhabits a breath like an anodyne. And I think I could call this poem an Abaud if it detailed new breath departing his mouth. I think I could get away with that because who knows what that even means. Maybe I mean that's safer than saying it straight, like, this is about the woman I'll marry. How one summer she hit snooze four times each sunrise. This is about her smiling and nodding off and smiling and listening to me mumble into the back of her perfect freckled shoulder about anything but poetry. And this morning at my desk, in the midst of a breath I remember, not every moment needs naming. I know precisely what to call this. And then we broke up. Yeah. So, Silencer, it comes out August 17, and many of the poems are about gun violence perpetrated against the black body. And then there are poems that are in discussion with a higher power, the existence of a higher power, whether you believe in that or not. And then there are poems that, there's sort of an intersection there, poems about theodicy, right? The existence of evil or why bad things happen to good people, and they sort of merge with that gun violence. I started writing these silencers several years back. I was living in Evansville, Indiana, and I had this crew of fellas. We'd go out for dinner every other week, diverse group of people in terms of occupation and skin tone, but maybe not so diverse. I guess I was the only black one. Often we'd get in these conversations, and we'd talk about everything under the sun. But whenever we talked about gun violence, they'd get really, really quiet, or they'd change the subject quickly and sort of dash me off. And so in those moments, I felt like I was being silenced. And I do what I always do, right? I'll write a poem about it just to get something off of my heart, or, you know, it's just my gut response. So I started writing these silencers that address gun violence. Often they'll mention characteristics about the victims of gun violence, but they'll sort of go around the back door to get at that. And here's the first one I wrote. Silencer to the heart while jogging through a park. I shouldn't have to go here with you. A bandit ties the farmer's dog to a century oak by the untouched creek. You see, human interest piece. Sunny and rounding out the evening news, where I see Eclipse casket. Where I say, released, he will roam the same radius. Surely, I don't have to tell you, there's a gun, semi-automatic and lodged in the blackberry thicket. But I do have to tell you about the semi-automatic jail cell clanging open. Not for me, because that's just sound world-making. I'll say it like this. I don't jog in the park with my blind side shaded anymore. Look, here, through the spangled screen door, there was once a kid, ordinary in every American leisure except one. I won't name him. You'll look away. Again, there was too much shepherd's pie, a slice of apple, and one sturdy carving knife. In damp air hung glints of siren moon, few sirens, sleepy porch lamps blinking on, and an ache for antacids that jogged a man to the corner store like puttering wind. Then back over the town's little blacktop hills near the park's edge where there was a shot streetlight and lots of wheezing over a bench. And there were three shadows, a pit bull tied to the bench, and a bulge in his gut that was a bulge in his gut which must have looked to one shadow like a box cutter and not a roll of Tums. And then there are frankly too many black cherry thickets streaked with blood. Sometimes I can barely walk out into daylight wearing a cotton sweatshirt without trembling. And surely I don't have to tell you who gets put down, which one walks away. So, Friday, Donald Trump will be sworn in as our next president, and I'm a little over feeling dread about that, just because it takes up so much psychic and emotional space. But during those debates, when asked about policing, the only thing that I remember Trump saying was he supports stop and frisk, which we all know is just another way to profile. And that does bring me dread, a great sense of dread. And that's a tough pill for me to swallow. Taking aim at a Macy's changing room mirror, I blame television. No chain link fences leapt in a single bound. No juke move Nike commercial, speeding bullet skittled hued cross trainers. No brown skin Adonis weaving trails of industrial Vaseline down a cobblestone street. Heisman shucking trash receptacles. Grand jeté over the little blue recycling bin, a prism of clouds rising beneath his feet. Nobody all fucked in boot cuffs, wide enough to cloak court-appointed tethers. Or slumped over, hoodie-shrouded, sheepishly scary, according to one eyewitness. Definitely not gonna be your Louis V sweatsuit, red carpet fashion review coming at you live from E! And Fox News outside of the morgue. No chance for homeboy in the peekaboo boxer shorts. Homeboy with the frozen wrists iced. Home slice with the paisley pretty flocco flag flying by the seat of low-slung denim. No defense attorney gets to call me gang-related. Tupac in a mock leather bomber. No statement taken from the Clint Eastwood of your particular planned community saying he had the right to stand his ground at the Super Target. Because my flat build fitted cap cast a shady shadow over his shoulder in the checkout line. No siree. See, I practice self-target practice. There is no sight of me in my wares. I, bedecked in no wrinkled Dockers, sensible navy blazer, Barack Obama tie, double consciousness knotted, stock dandelion, pinned to the skin of an American lapel with his head blown off. Good to get that one out. All right. There's an epigraph here. For in the one spirit, we were all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, and all were made to drink of one spirit. That's from 1 Corinthians 12:13, if you're keeping score. Conjecture on the stained glass image of white Christ at Ebenezer Baptist Church. If in his image made him I, then make me a miracle. Make my shrine a copper faucet leaking everlasting Evian to the masses. Make this empty water glass a goblet of long-legged French wine. Make mine a Prince Purple body bag designed by Crown Royal for tax collectors to spill over and tide into just before I rise. If in his image made him I, then make my vessel a pearl, Coupe de Ville. Make mine the body of a 28-year-old black woman in a blue pattern maxi dress, cruising through hell on earth, Texas, again, alive. If in his image made her we, then why the endless string of effigies? Why so many mortal blasphemies? Why crucify me in HD across a scrolling news ticker tied to a clothesline of broken necks long as time? Is this thing on? Jesus on the ground, Jesus in the margins of hurricane and sea, Jesus of busted levees and chocolate cities, Jesus of the Middle East, Africa, and crows flying backwards, of blood on the leaves inside diamond mines and underdeveloped mineral-rich countries. If in your image made are we, the proliferation of your tie-dyed hippie doppelganger makes you easier to daily see. And in this image, didn't we make the Godhead slightly stony, high enough to surf a cloud? And didn't we leave you there where surely paradise or justice must be meted out? Couldn't we see where water takes the form of whatever most holds it upright? If then this is what it's come down to, my faith in rifle shells, in Glock 22 magazine sleeves, isn't it also then how, why, in a bucket shot full of holes I've been made to believe? I'm looking at you all, and you look like LL Cool J fans. So this is for you, I guess. When I'm alone in my room, sometimes I stare at the wall, and in the back of my mind, I hear my conscience call me Ishmael. Call me sailor, but not captain. Call me fishhook, clean. Call me multi-purpose fist scale, weighing self-obsession. Call me fishtail in a siren's silk sheets, thief in the night, buccaneer Call me multi-purpose fist scale singing motherfucker, then calling it good. Call me lukewarm algae eater, upchucked. Call me match head struck against hollow whale walls. Call me faith's phosphorus irritation. The Bible study leading SeaWorld trainer, dead between Shamu's teeth. Call me Freightliner Hull, hacking through a baby humpback, extinct and extinguished, son of a slave girl, expelled to the desert for being himself. Call me miracle, opposite mirage, three parts sea but bountiful land. Call me mangy pasture, wild buffalo, archer, arrow. Call me sheared, call me back to the shepherd, call me lamb. It was gonna go there, did you? I didn't either. No. So AWP is coming up. That's the big writers conference for creative writers. I like AWP because I get to see all my buddies that I've met along the way, all the other poets and fiction writers that I know and love. But there's also this element at AWP of sort of hangers-on, like you're talking to someone, you're getting to know them, and they're looking over your shoulder to see if there's someone more infamous than you in the room. And so I'm doing what I always do. I wrote a poem to those people. There's an epigraph here. It's from America's Next Top Model. I'm not here to make friends. Ars Poetica battle rhyme for really wanna be somebody's. This is for my Liz Taylor literati. Gaudy darlings, ear hustling your way into and through ill-lit poet soirees, all kinds of illegitimate, like you heard who's a sure thing for which distinguished fellowship? The one with the not-so-super secretive selection panel and one percenter endowment. And who was it who spotted Mark so-and-so canoodling with D.B. Wong last AWP over extra wet martinis, top shelf, 12th floor of the Hyatt Regency? I see you checking your Rolodexes. Feckless. Y'all some young acting Eddie Murphys to me. Too good at doing impressions for comfort. Must have fell asleep dreaming of feature readings and never woke up. Oh, really wanna be ass somebody's? Go sit down somewhere and shed. Quit stalling, squawking like a sucker, and open up. Come off it, cousin. Think your favorite famous so-and-so never feared what he couldn't yet do? Think you're the first fool with a laptop to ever arrive at a blank screen and ask, is this enough? I would talk to you all at AWP and not look over your shoulder. So also in the book, there's a section called Cul-de-sac Pastoral. You know, I'm at the point where thinking about how I'd want to live. Do I want to live in the sort of cul-de-sac community that my parents live in, where all the houses look the same, they're really close, but the neighbors don't really know each other, or elsewhere, right? I'm not quite sure. This is sort of a true story. I came home from Indiana one summer, and the power went out in my folks' neighborhood, like a huge transformer, and I saw these kids outside sort of like staring at a football, just like looking at it on the ground, like, what the fuck do we do now, you know? There's no Xbox. Creation song in which a swift wind sucker punches a transformer. In which the transformer heaves projectile from the telephone pole. In which the pole snaps awake, its miter box guts emptied out over an oscillating fan. In which atomized rot reigns atop the crabapple's pet name pheromones, in which nobody notices. Creation song in which electrified shrapnel voids, bedazzled yard gnome, limestone garden ornaments, remote control Ferrari, real life Range Rover in which somebody notices. Creation song in which six kids crowd around pigskin, curious, the tallest boy prodding the ball with a stick. Creation song in which your online bank account is unavailable. in which your exquisite 60-inch flat screen is an HD plastic heap, in which the matchstick feels paleolithic and you could be making love, creation song in which unattended sparks sizzle along a chain link fence, in which everyone heads for the gates. I'm gonna read you one more Ann Arbor poem. Don't hold that against me. Film noir at Gallup Park on the edge of suburbia in flux behind one of the town's, count 'em, two mega high schools. The sometimes tended to nature preserve where green and green slide crisp between brisk handshakes, where a middle-aged Jimmy John's driver suddenly halts his 98 Corolla, goes noiseless, where the sun isn't exactly booming, but it's Sunday morning and I'm in my feelings, so I clop off a few paces, nice and easy-like. I mouth, hello to the lovable maintenance man. Hello, lovable maintenance man, I nod. He fusses with his mustache, flicks it out in a full tilt wave. In the way of mise-en-scene, I know I said that wrong, I feel compelled to say it's 2014. I'm a black American poet, newly 30 and middle class for the Midwest. So far, it's the summer of two brothers unarmed, erased, posterized. Two more, and I live my best days outside like this, under threat of rain. Me, my bad form, and no one looking on with the evil anvil of a hoisted eyebrow. The deceptive flip of an A-line bob, hand-readied to protect the old moneymaker. Accordingly, smoke. A slinky Asian teen makes his body into a nickel, wheels up the wide alley between me and the trail's opposite edge. Our shades, night slick, reflect one another. Different frames from about the same shelf. I catch myself for an instant in his left lens and wonder, is it the Rocky look I'm rocking? Was it the bare bones, bone white, hooded Egyptian cotton tracksuit drawn tight around my head like a swim cap? It's summer here. Are the ox calves teetering a chest somewhere between barrel and breasted, depending on the wind? The Taylor Swift red grin of my diabolical office nemesis, or the moon cycle, maybe anything, Finn. In the director's cut, I'm the one being fatally femme. I pretend to check my face in a rearview mirror, pull a plume from a pinner, and squeeze the trigger on a can of lavender Febreze. I chase myself out the window, smarting every time someone flinches at the sight of me. Metaphorically, I could only be the pitch dark asphalt simmering in this parking lot, the fog lifting off a black tar river already gone. Though, obviously, given the opportunity, nay the luck, I'd play delivery boy, even maintenance dude, anything but walking dead man, and I'll be damned if I didn't just run all this way to tell you that. Fuck. Very kind. So I do this thing, I've been writing a lot about jogging in my poems. And maybe that's because, you know, I fail at that sometimes in person, but I can get it right on the page. So here's another poem in which a speaker, maybe not me, a speaker is jogging, but it takes place in Bloomington, Indiana. It's one of those poems, to a higher power, in conversation with a higher power. It's called Incident with Nature, Late. Clean, the gust prying me open for the first time this week, as I, not exactly win-like in the running, 30 and already hunched over after three stoic blocks and one big sloppy knock into the neighbor's knotty fence, decided as good a place as any to stop, pant, and smell the roses. Except there are no roses, proverbial or otherwise. Except a nondescript shrub, quivering with what I hereby dub the pininess of an Indiana marsh. And oh my God, it feathering my nose hairs, stirring in me a place where finally I decide to quit dicking around and dig my face in it. Low bent, hands cupped over kneecaps, my eyes adjusting always for some throbbing. This sweet bumblebee, rushing through an interstate of arteries and wishbone forks and the bush's gut for a derelict cherry bloom wearing blush. That hummingbird in hot pursuit. Humming little drone, holy shit, I swivel too late, and she hammers her needle beak through my ear, drills hard the run of bone behind my lobe and sticks. All my life, I've been biblically acquainted with the donkey face sting of a vertebral night. Usually some small game slight, some gnat-sized fowl wedging itself in where there had always been light, but just then momentarily less. So predictably me, I wave it in. Let it pitch a tent in my living room, bore heavy-duty stakes through the pergo floor. Let it crack walnuts with my violet mini stapler, split dishes with the weight of peat moss brick lasagna, this lazy ache. I let him knock around inside my record crates, floss his beak with the grooves of my favorite 45 until all I am is a busted song of nerve tentacles swimming beneath the pink umbrella of a redbud tree, or all I am is a singing saw through a bell of flesh. The point being, not the ear, but maybe the thorn is God, little winged and hovering here, quietly in me, when I sit real still to feel my nature opening its mouth to speak. I'm gonna read you just a few more here. Sometimes I talk about my work, especially my more politically charged work, as using a sleight of hand, right? I think that because poetry is so connected to academia, I'll just come right out and say it. I think that I know that a large chunk of my readers will be white, which is cool. Buy my book, please. But sometimes I use a sleight of hand just in case you might be put off, for instance, by some rhetoric, right? Some straight-ahead rhetoric about Black Lives Matter, for instance. I hope that you wouldn't be, right? But I will show you something that you want to see, like a cocktail party or a rainbow, and then go for the throat. This is literally about sleight of hand, though. When academia tells me only a fool believes in a God that he can't see, I draw them in from a crowded street with a wink and an eye towards the big guy's wallet. I sink into myself, into my spot behind the cardboard box, dropped just here, a prop. Keep your eyes on the ace of hearts, not the ping-ponging pair of clubs. Watch the watch, just my white gold watch, not the wrist flickering, windshield wipers, shuffling glove hands, not this hand over hand watch we keep over one another's peach sunsets, one's palm trees and green leaves, one's narcotic happiness or holiness when the heart of the matter is the magic is me. A lot of my friends are poets, and sometimes we'll give each other challenges. Whenever I'm stuck, if I've got what you call writer's block, I'll say, give me a challenge. And so a friend dared me to write a poem entirely composed of bird names. And I made it. about 8 lines before I quit. There's an epigraph here from St. Paul, pray without ceasing. I guess the other thing that I'll say is when it comes to prayer, and this book is steeped in prayer, and it's something that I do often, whether I know it or not, it's just sort of a part of my natural cadence. I spend a lot of time thinking about intention versus execution, like what I can get away with praying for as long as I'm sincere, right? Plea to my jealous heart. What's funny is that you think I can stop praying, that you think I take existence, blown dandelion across the philtrum, lightly, as irresponsible bird song, as the wren, finch, chickadee, and prairie warbler, as scarlet tanager, indigo bunting, laughing gull, trumpeter swan, as common sparrows outside my window, canting dervish loops, sparrows that court the air and multiply, as all the love at all times everywhere, you think I take too much in. You think I take communion wine for granted. Sometimes the other wine touches me sweetly and you know it. All the time you know it. This and how communion wine indebts me as the man granted new eyes on a hiking trip, how when his boot met wet dune, he felt the sinking in. And still you think I can stop praying? How hummingbird, how sailfish, mother of pearl moth, little dragonfly, old faithful greyhound. Oh, elephant herd in a room of rodents, how you have me delirious, haggard, hungrier to hear you at all times if it'll keep you redlining reverently. That's how I love you best. As stethoscope, not scalpel. As ever flickering filament, not kite, a joined key. Forgive me, a sinner afraid of lightning, but when I ask you out, oh whistling tailpipe, you suck air from lungs. I inhale and need you, and you know it, as whisper, as hum. As trade wind and storm, you show yourself, no matter my asking. And when I ask, oh elegant cyclone, you wrench flesh from bone, bone from hip socket. What's funny is that tender tendon is the blessing, and you know my blurred bones, my blood, you corset. You know my slow capacity for recovery. What's funny is I feel bad for that, and you think I can stop praying? When my lover locks our pinkies in a crowded art gallery, I praise the body. Praise every kissable knuckle, every painstakingly etched wave and a fingerprint, and you think I could take a host for granted? Oh, sinner of everybody, oh, all-knowing ebless Red Sea, I want to look in your face and live this beautifully always. Oh, metacarpal, proximal, oh, distal phalange, all-powerful finger in a breastplate, touch me light as a feather, please, jog in place. Last poem, appreciate you coming out. You could have been watching NCIS or something. How do I want to phrase this? A lot of my friends think that all poets do is just go to really exquisite cocktail parties, which is kind of true, but not all cocktail parties are created equal. There's an epigraph here. It's the day that I wrote the poem. June 18th, 2015, watch us elocute. So I'm at this party, right? Low light, champagne, Michael Bublé, and a gang of loafers I'm forever dancing around, and unduly charged conversations. Your favorite accompanist, Bill Evans behind Miles, ever present in few strokes when into the room walks this potentially well-meaning WASPy woman, obviously from Connecticut money, boasting an extensive background in nonprofit arts management. And without much coaxing from me, really, none at all, she whoops, "Gosh, you're just so well-spoken." And I'm like, "Duh, son." So then we both clink glasses, drink to whatever that was. Naturally, not till the next morning and from under a scalding shower do I shout, "Yes, ma'am, some of us does talk good." To no one in particular but the drain holes. No one but the off-white tile grout, the loofah's yellow pores. Because I come from a long braid of dangerous men who learn to talk their way out of small compartments. My own Spartan walls line with their faces. Ellison and Ellington, Langston, Robeson, Frederick Douglass above the bench press and the gym, but to no avail. Without fail, when I'm at the Cross-Eyed Cricket, that's a real diner, it's in Indiana, and some pimple-faced ginger waiter lingers nervous and doth protest too much, it's always, "Sir, you ever been told you sound like Bryant Gumbel?" Which is cute, because he's probably 10. But then sometimes I sit in his twin section and he once predicted I could do a really wicked impression of Wayne Brady. I know for a fact his name is Jim. I've got Jim's 18th birthday blazed on my bedside calendar. It reads, "Ass whipping, 12 a.m. And like, actually, that woman from the bi-monthly CV building gala can kick rocks because she's old enough to be my mother and educated, if only by her own appraisal, but boy. Dear boys, sweet, freckled what's-his-face and dipshit Jim, we can still be play friends. Your folks didn't explain I'd take your trinket praise as teeny blade, a trillionth microaggression against and beneath my skin. Little buddies, that soars on me. I know what you mean, that I must seem safe. But let's get this straight. Let's call a spade a poor choice of words. Ali, I might not be, though. At the very least, a heavyweight throwback, Nat King Cole singing silky and subliminal about the unforgettable model minority. NBC believed Nat and his eloquence could have single-handedly defeated Jim Crow. Fact, they were wrong. Of this, I know. And not because they canceled his show in 57 after one season, citing insufficient sponsorship, or because in 1948, the KKK flamed a cross on his LA lawn. But because yesterday, literally yesterday, some simple American citizen, throwback supremacist straight out of Birmingham, 1963, aimed his 45 and emptied the life from 9 black believers at an AME church in Charleston. Among them, a pastor senator, an elderly tenor, beloved librarian, a barber with a business degree who adored his mom and wrote poems about the same age as me. I'm sorry. No friends. None of us is safe. Thank you.